Pushkin. Legacy of Speed is executive produced by Tracksmith and presented by Puma. 1968, Mexico City. The Olympics are about to start and the city is in turmoil. The Mexican army is occupying the National Polytechnic Institute, one of the largest universities in the country, desperate to stop a wave of student rebellion. The students respond by gathering at a local plaza, chanting in Spanish, "We don't want Olympics, we want revolution." Troops in armored cars surround the square. The army would claim later that a sniper fired at them. Eyewitnesses said the army fired first.
The army is here and they're firing. They're letting go with just about everything they have. The other troops have swept across the plaza.
The shooting went on for an hour and a half. Hundreds of people were arrested, bodies lying on the streets. The death toll was in the hundreds. Then, 10 days later, in another part of Mexico City, the games began, as if nothing had happened. Lord Exeter, number two to Avery Brundage at the International Olympic Committee, told the press, quote, "The riots have nothing to do with the Olympic Games. The students are not protesting against the games, but against the Mexican government," unquote. Sports, in the ideology of the International Olympic Committee, had nothing to do with politics. But if you were a member of Speed City, flying into Mexico City to represent the United States, how could you see things that way? These were students, just like they were, young people, just like they were, standing up for what they believed in. And what happened? They were shot in the street. The injustice of it all hit Tommy Smith hard.
Freedom of speech, educational quality, dealing with the financial plight of the country spending more money on the Olympic Games than they did on the people to survive in the city. And many were killed because of it. So the place would be clean of any social disturbances once we got there, but sometimes kind of hard to clean blood off of cement. So you still saw the stains once we got there. So we knew that we were moving into a very dangerous situation.
My name is Malcolm Gladwell, and from Pushkin Industries, Tracksmith, and Puma, this is Legacy of Speed, a story about athletes who dared to take a stand and the visionaries who made them fast enough and brave enough to change the world. This episode is about the strange and unsettling experience that was the Mexico City Games, where the line that Avery Brundage and his cohorts had been telling the world for years, that sports were a shining cathedral on a hill, was challenged by a handful of young men from San Jose State. Tommy Smith, John Carlos, and Lee Evans. The Mexico City Games were the first truly modern Olympics, the first time the athletics track had a synthetic surface instead of cinders, the first time electronic timing was used in races instead of officials holding stopwatches, and the first time the Games were the international televised spectacle that we've come to expect today. ABC paid $4.5 million for the rights to the 68 Games. That was triple the cost of the previous Olympics. For the first time ever in the TV era, the Summer Olympics were happening in North America in the Central Time Zone. The biggest team in Mexico City wasn't the Soviet Union. It was ABC's broadcast crew.
You'll be able to experience as never before the exploits of the world's greatest athletes in track and field, swimming and diving, gymnastics and rowing. The whole brilliant panorama of 20 Summer Olympic sports.
Anchoring ABC's coverage was Howard Cosell, one of the greatest, most divisive sports commentators of all time, who understood immediately that the stakes in these games were different.
They say the games are sports, not politics, something separate and apart from the realities of life. The U.S. Olympic Committee, in the manner of the fabled village of Brigadoon, appears on the scene once every 4 years. It is in the main a group of pompous, arrogant, medieval-minded men who regard the games as a private social preserve for their tiny clique.
Kosel could name-drop Brigadoon while eviscerating the Olympic aristocracy, then turn around and explain black power to ABC viewers in just a few words.
The black athlete says he is part of a revolution designed to produce dignity for the black man. He says that he will not be used once every 4 years on behalf of a group that ignores what happens to him every day of all the years.
He understood, even before the games began, that this was going to be an event. On the one hand, Avery Brundage, blind to the blood on the streets of Mexico City, obsessed with maintaining the purity of the games.
I don't think any of these boys will be foolish enough to demonstrate at the Olympic Games. And I think if they do, they'll be promptly sent home.
I don't think any of these boys. Boys. Why do you think they called him Slavery Avery? And then, on the other side, the young men of Speed City, like Tommy Smith. Let's talk about Mexico City. What was that like? What was going through your head as you arrived there for the Olympics?
There was a lot of things happening then politically, and then also the politics in Mexico City at the time, the need for the Olympic Project for Human Rights to be understood to fruition.
By this point in his career, Smith had achieved celebrity status. He'd been on the cover of Sports Illustrated and Newsweek. He'd helped lead an Olympic boycott movement. Tommy Smith juggled all this, and he wasn't even out of school.
There was a lot of pressure, and I just had turned 24 years old, and I had not graduated yet. You had the threats on my life. I had a wife and a son who was born in February of 68.
Did you say that there were threats on your life?
Oh, yeah, there were threats on my life. My goodness, in 67. You know, we get phone calls, and the voice on the other end, don't try anything, or is your life worth what you're doing?
The cameras were rolling. The world was watching. Mexico City was a primetime cliffhanger. If gold medal favorites like Tommy Smith, John Carlos, and Lee Evans got to the victory stand, what would they do? How far would they go? Here's Smith in an interview he did for the documentary called The Stand. You'll hear quite a bit of it in this episode, along with my own interview with him.
This was a lot of pressure on me, knowing I not only wanted to get to the victory stand, I wanted to get to the first place on the victory stand.
Mexico City sat 7,300 feet above sea level. The thin air would add an element of unpredictability to the games. It would make some athletes sick and hinder their performance. It would enable others to jump higher, leap farther, and set new records. Qualifying heats for the 200 meters were held in a mammoth stadium. Smith performed well, but so did Smith's teammate, John Carlos, and a wiry Australian named Peter Norman.
Carlos getting through on the inside is running a beautifully balanced race. Norman, however, is heading him up. Can he run a 22? Or
then, in the semifinal for the 200 meters, disaster struck for Tommy Smith.
Look at Tommy Smith riding up for the line. He's going to win this by several yards.
As I came around the curve, I forgot that I was going 18 miles an hour. And his left knee moved about 2 inches. And that's what yanked the groin muscle out of track. It felt like somebody had shot me. That's what I thought. Oh, my God.
Because of the death threats he and other athletes received, Smith was worried about a gunman in the stands. This was October 1968. Just months before, assassins had shot and killed Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy.
Now, as I looked down, there was no blood. And I remember thinking, oh, it's just a muscle. Oh, just, I might as well have been shot, you know, because now my whole Olympic dream is over. Olympic Project for Human Rights is out the door. People will never think of me again.
Smith crossed the finish line and began limping. The final was just 2 hours away. We'll be right back. Recently, I sat down with Tracksmith founder and CEO Matt Taylor to learn more about the brand and why they wanted to tell the story of Speed City through this oral history.
I, like you, have been a runner my entire life. I love it. I love the sport. Running is a part of who I am. But I felt like there was so much more that could be done in terms of how the sport is presented and how it makes people feel. And so I started Tracksmith in 2014 to make people fall in love with running.
So the project, the Bud Winter Speed City project, where did that come from?
the image of Tommy Smith and John Carlos on the podium in Mexico City with their gloved fists raised in the air, it has to be one of the most recognizable photos of our generation. But a photo only captures a moment in time, right? It's like a snapshot with no commentary. And as powerful as an image that was, as a track and field athlete and a fan of the sport, I always wanted to know more. And so as I got to learn more about that story, there were really two parts that felt extremely compelling to me. One was, how did this tiny school in California produce so many world-class athletes? San Jose State was not an athletics powerhouse, but in the 1968 Olympics, they won 3 gold medals and a bronze, which was amazing. And then two, the legacy of Speed City, its sort of impact on the world as we see it today, is not that well known, both in terms of athletic performance, but also social justice.
More than just incredible products, Tracksmith tells stories and creates experiences that make running more rewarding. This show is just one example. Learn more at tracksmith.com/legacyofspeed and get 15% off your first purchase. After the 200-meter semifinal, Tommy Smith had to be helped off the track by athletes and trainers. They took him to a nearby training room. His crotch was packed with ice to slow the swelling of the pulled groin muscle. His head started to hurt. Then he looked up and saw a familiar face.
My coach, Lloyd C. Budwinner, called him Bud, came down and he said, Tom-Tom, how are you? He called me Tom-Tom. Tom-Tom, how are you doing? I said, I'm doing fine, coach. That's stupid. I'm just laying there with a pack of ice in between my legs and I'm feeling fine. Well, no, Tommy, you're hurt. That's what I'm thinking.
They iced the injury on and off. Then, with 40 minutes to go before the final, Bud walked Smith out to an elevated practice field nearby. It overlooked the Olympic Stadium. Smith could see the track where he was supposed to run the race of his life that night. It was getting dark out.
Bud Winner said, okay, Tom-Tom, I'm going down here 40 meters and I just want you to work it up about the 10 miles an hour. Okay, coach. I do anything my coach wanted me. I just run.
And it was first go quarter speed, Tommy, go half speed, Tommy.
He said, keep the stride down. Don't make it only about 5 feet stride. Don't do too much. Okay, coach. He said, okay, I'm going 80 meters now, do the same thing. Get about 80% speed. Walk back, 80% speed. Now I'm conscious of this left knee. Turn that sucker in about half a degree so the leg won't fly out.
Do you think Bud Winner thought that you wouldn't win, that your injury was so serious? I mean, how worried was he about your ability to actually run the final?
This man worried about all of his athletes. And I think he had a great worry for me because I had really never experienced anything like this.
I looked back, looked down at the stadium, because we were up, the stadium was down, and I thought it might be my last time. I thought it might be my last time.
Bud and Smith heard an announcement over the loudspeakers.
First call for the 200 meters. And so I walked from there down to the track over to where the 200 meters started. And I was afraid to take starts because I didn't want to completely destroy the muscle just practicing starts. So I had to stand there. That was the most devastating thing mentally that I had done in track and field, to watch these athletes start. So you could see, and this is documented, you could see me gradually and slowly coming out of my sweats to get in the blocks for the race.
The 200 meters starts on one curve of the track oval. Runners start from staggered positions so that everyone runs the same distance. The farther a lane is from the inside, the farther down the starting block. Smith had drawn one of the best assignments, lane 3. Most of his competition would start ahead of him, where he could keep an eye on them. That included John Carlos, who also had a good assignment, lane 4. Meanwhile, Peter Norman had drawn lane 6, which was less than ideal. The Australian, who had broken the Olympic record in the qualifiers, would start with the most competitive runners behind him.
So we got in the blocks, and last thing I remember, the guy said, on your marks. That's it. But I do remember the explosion.
Peter Norman did get a good start, I thought. Smith is doing well, and his leg seems to be standing up okay. Look at Carlos go in the center of the field and Quest there.
I remember the first step, it felt good. Second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth. By the 12th stride, I was pushing, coming into the straightaway. And I knew that I had to be very cautious about the exchange from a curve to a straightaway.
Smith watched John Carlos and Peter Norman ahead of him. He was the current world record holder, and he was in fourth place. Not good.
Trying to alleviate not only the pain, but the need not to do too much to blow the whole race.
Everything just stopped, and my mind went back to training at San Jose State. And I remember Bud Winter, my coach, said, perfect positions. We always ran this in practice. Perfect position, which is knees, which is ankle flip, which is head, which is elbows, which is everything. Perfect. And I felt that.
They passed the curve. It was all straightaway from there on out.
Maybe 110 meters ago. And that's when all of the practices came into being. Not a thought, but a muscle memory of what it felt like, the science of speed, to come in.
Coming down the straightaway, Tommy Smith surged ahead in lane three. In lane four, John Carlos turned to his left as Smith passed him. But while he's looking left, Carlos is missing what's happening on his right. With only a few strides to go, the Australian, Peter Norman, jets down the straightaway and closes the gap with Carlos. Here's how it looked from Norman's point of view.
John looked to his left, looking for Tommy Smith, but Tommy was gone past him by that time. And then John said to himself, oh shoot, the white boy.
Smith pulled one all, couldn't have pulled it that badly. He beat John Carlos. And Peter Norman could have run a second place.
Norman took the silver, Carlos got the bronze. Tommy Smith won it all and set a world record with his time of 19.83.
It was the first time that furlong was run under 20 seconds.
Tommy, wait, you broke the world record and won the gold medal with a pulled groin?
That's a fact.
Oh, my goodness.
That's a fact.
Peter Norman, Tommy Smith, and John Carlos would soon take to the victory stand. And because of the decisions they would make over the next 30 minutes, all three sprinters would be linked with one another for the rest of their lives. We'll be right back. Tommy Smith, John Carlos, and Peter Norman had just run the fastest 200-meter race in history. Each sprinter finished with a time that surpassed the existing world record. Norman had squeaked past Carlos at the last second for Olympic silver, but Smith finished ahead of both men, his arms raised in triumph at the finish line. He got the gold. Carlos insists that the real reason he went to Mexico was to make good on what had all started with the Olympic Project for Human Rights.
That's the main reason why I went. It wasn't about no medal, that I had to win a medal to get on the victory stand. Now, I didn't go there anticipating taking third. I was giving the medal to Tommy. But see, that's where God steps in. Well, God put Peter Norman there to make this thing solidify.
Peter Norman wasn't an activist. He wasn't black. He wasn't even American. He was a white sprinter from Australia, but he was going to the medal stand with Smith and Carlos. After the race, the three sprinters were directed to a room where they would wait for the medal ceremony. Smith called it the dungeon.
I guess it was the preparation room for medal winners before the stand. And John and I did talk. What are we going to do?
Carlos remembers it was all up in the air.
And then we roughly had 25 minutes before we went out there to figure out exactly what we was going to do and how we was going to do it. Nobody knew what we was going to do. Peter didn't know what we was going to do until we started dealing with it in front of him.
The way Smith recalls it, they were all trying to figure out what to do with a pair of black gloves he'd brought.
And it was decided between the two of us, I would take my right glove, he could have the left, and I'm going to raise my hand over my head as soon as the national anthem started playing to emphasize solidarity and strength, Not black power sign. Not that at all. Solidarity and strength. And he decided to take the left glove and do the same thing I did with the same feelings in mind.
Today, Smith and Carlos disagree about some of the details of the planning, but they do agree that Peter Norman asked them about the white buttons pinned to their track jackets. They said, Olympic Project for Human Rights, in black capital letters down the middle, with olive wreaths on each side. Norman asked if he could wear one. Carlos was skeptical of the white Australian.
And I asked Peter, I said, man, do you believe in human rights? And that's when Peter began to tell me about his mom and his dad was Salvation Army workers all of his life.
In fact, the Salvation Army went back generations in Norman's family. Their faith was focused on acts of charity, giving food and blankets to people living on the streets, working in prisons, visiting youth detention centers. Norman was raised to recognize when people needed help and then do something about it. The problem? Neither Tommy Smith nor John Carlos had an extra OPHR button to spare. They had to find the keepers of the OPHR swag, which turned out to be the white, Harvard-educated members of the U.S. rowing team. Minutes before the medal ceremony, Carlos and Norman found the crew team's coxswain. Norman asked him, hey, mate, you got another one of those? There was no time to find an extra. The coxswain removed his and handed it to Norman. Here's Smith.
He wore the button because he believed in civil rights. He did not wear the button, my beliefs, to back John Carlos and Tommy Smith. Peter was a very strong, very proud, very innovative person when it came to loving the human being. He wore the button because he believed.
It was time for the medal ceremony. The three sprinters headed out towards the victory stand with OPHR buttons pinned to their track jackets. Tommy Smith and John Carlos were each wearing a black glove.
They also wore beads and scarves, which was supposed to represent the history of lynching in the United States.
This is Dave Zirin, sports editor for The Nation magazine.
John Carlos had his jacket open on the medal stand, which was a huge breach of Olympic protocol. He associated that with working with your hands, about having a jacket unzipped. And so they didn't wear shoes on the medal stand in protest of poverty in the United States and people who didn't have money for shoes.
The black socks they wore as they walked out to the stand were like those worn by other black U.S. athletes in Mexico City. At a time when athletic socks were almost always white, these socks were meant to send a message about black poverty. Smith mounted the highest position on the podium and raised his arms in the air, soaking in the glory for just a moment. He accepted his gold medal. Then Peter Norman and John Carlos took their places. The sprinters turned 90 degrees on the podium to face their country's flags. Now they were standing single file on the staggered steps of the victory stand. Norman was in front and couldn't see what was happening behind him. Smith was in the middle.
When I looked around, I didn't know that there were that many people in the world. It seemed like everybody in the world was in that stadium.
When the Star Spangled Banner played, Smith put his fist into the air and bowed his head. Behind him, Carlos followed suit.
When my fist went up, silence captivated that stadium. Silence.
Smith and Carlos kept their fists in the air for the duration of the anthem. 1:15. Smith recited the Lord's Prayer silently in his head. Carlos said he was waiting for an assassin's bullet.
It was gasps, and it was stillness, quiet. People were like,
That's Kathy Winter. She was in the stands next to her father, Bud Winter.
And all of a sudden, I saw his face change. And it was horror that came over his face because he knew what would happen. I did not understand at all the political ramifications and what it took for these guys to do that. I didn't understand. So all I knew was something awful had happened.
Bert Bonanno, Bud's friend and a fellow coach, was also there.
That incident was immediately seen by the world. I mean, the whole freaking world.
Bonanno stood with Bud and Kathy as the silence turned to something else.
There was a lot of chaos in the stands, people talking, people booing, people applauding. Bud and I looked at each other. We were trying to figure out how to way to get to John and Tommy. We weren't able to do it.
As the three sprinters walked off the field together, Smith and Carlos looked into the crowd and raised their fists again. Smith says they were booed and catcalled as they exited. Carlos says they were called the N-word and told to go back to Africa. Bud and Bonanno quickly left their seats.
We walked out of the stadium. The question for us to decipher is, what do we do now?
The first outsider to fully understand the moment was Howard Cosell.
Tommy, would you explain to the people of America exactly what you did and why you did it?
The right glove that I wore on my right hand signified the power within Black America.
Smith went on to explain the meaning of the other objects in his protest. The scarf, the socks without shoes.
Do you think you represented all Black athletes in doing this?
I can say I represented Black America.
I can say I represented Black America. For anyone unable to interpret the symbolism of that moment, the socks, the scarf, the gloves, the fist, Smith was spelling it out. I am not just here as a runner representing the U.S. Olympic team. I am here as an ambassador for my race in order to make a political statement. Avery Brundage was nowhere to be found during the medal ceremony. This was one of the marquee events of the whole games. A world record had been set. Brundage usually was on stage for those moments, basking in the reflected glory of the runners. But he knew that standing next to Smith and Carlos, while they made a mockery of his Olympic vision, would have been a recipe for humiliation. In the end, he made his displeasure known by issuing a statement that called the demonstration, quote, a deliberate and violent breach of the fundamental principles of the Olympic spirit. A violent breach? Two men with their fists raised was violence? This was the same man who heard about the student massacre in the plaza and shrugged it off. The U.S. Olympic Committee responded with a formal apology and a stern warning against further protests. But Brundage wanted more. The next day, his executive committee hauled the U.S. Olympic Committee into a meeting. If the Americans wouldn't get rid of Smith and Carlos, the entire U.S. delegation would be expelled. The American team capitulated. Smith and Carlos were suspended. They would have to leave Mexico within 48 hours. Meanwhile, the reaction back home turned ugly. An editorial in the Chicago Tribune called the demonstration an embarrassment. The future TV sportscaster Brent Musburger, writing in the Chicago American paper, said Smith and Carlos looked like a couple of black-skinned stormtroopers. Smith, Carlos, and their wives were being hounded by reporters and photographers in Mexico City. John Carlos was getting tired of it.
I'm pretty pissed off already with a lot of white people, so leave me alone, okay? I'm asking you the last time. Next man come up and put a camera in my face, speak up in my face, I'm gonna knock him down and jump on him, yeah?
This was not the genteel Olympic Games, where athletes ran their races in an idyllic bubble. The games were now part of the real world. And the games, by the way, were far from over. Another Speed City sprinter was about to take to the track. Coming up in our next episode, the story of Lee Evans and the fallout from the Tommy Smith and John Carlos protest. But for now, I want to leave you with Howard Cosell, who never passed up a chance to deliver a stinging commentary.
And so the Olympic Games for the United States have become a kind of America in microcosm, a country torn apart. Where will it all end? Don't ask the U.S. Olympic Committee. They've been too busy preparing for a VIP cocktail party next Monday night in the lush new Camino Real. Howard Cosell reporting from Mexico City.
Legacy of Speed is hosted by me, Malcolm Gladwell. It's executive produced by Track Smith and presented by Puma. Our producers are Joel Meyer and Emily Rostek. The show is edited by Trisha Bobita and Karen Shikurji. And our mix engineer is Jake Gorski. Original music composed by Alexis Quadrado with trumpet by Lee Hogans. Fact-checking by Winton St. Clair. Our Pushkin EPs are Catherine Giraudot and Milo Bell. Our development team is Lital Molad and Justine Lang. We had help with research and archival material from Yerla Hill, Kathy Winter, Tom Ratcliffe, John Stalkup, and Carly Lowe. Some audio in this episode was courtesy of the documentary film The Stand, How One Gesture Shook the World. Additional audio courtesy of the documentary film Salute. Special thanks to Bud Winter Enterprises. Legacy of Speed is a production of Pushkin Industries. To find more Pushkin podcasts, listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.